We're very proud of our department. You guys know that we don't just talk about championships here. We deliver them, and our Ag Soils team is indicative of that. It's another story for another day, I suppose. Congressman Graves, you know, was born in Tarkio, Missouri, graduated from Missouri, University of Missouri. You know that he has served this great state since the early 90s, took his congressional seat in 2000. You also know that he and his wife have three children, right? I forget the ages, though. What are the ages?
He is 21, Trey's 17, Emily is 14.
All right, 21, 17, and 14. You know that he's a friend of education, of agriculture, and small business, being a small business owner, a farmer, six generations worth. Please give a warm Northwest welcome, Bearcat welcome, to Congressman Sam Graves.
President, I appreciate that very much, and the hospitality is unbelievable. That I really appreciate. Thanks for everybody for coming out. We're right in the middle of our August work break, which I'm moving around the district, just talking to folks and getting their ideas and thoughts, concerns, what I do just about every August. Kind of lay out the time frame for the rest of the year, how things are going to go. We'll be off until probably the second week in September. We'll go back into session from that point till probably August or October 1st, and then we'll break for the election, and then we'll come back in after the election in November and probably run through the first of the year or through January. It's hard to tell what's going to happen between now and then, between now and the election and then what happens after the election, because a lot of changes are going to happen. As far as the turnover in the House, it's hard to tell. It could be anywhere from 35 seats to 60 seats. It's just hard to tell. And you never know for sure because all elections come down to local politics. And it's hard to tell from the national side of things where we are. But what we do know for a fact is that there are going to be some seats that change hands. And we're a little concerned about some of the priorities and some of the things that are being pushed right now between now and January. Because regardless of what happens, if the House changes hands, then all of Speaker Pelosi's agenda pretty much goes out the window. If the House just gets even close to changing hands but doesn't, her agenda still goes out the window because they will not be able to pass some of the things that I want to talk about here in just a little bit. One of the things that isn't passing in Congress right now is a budget. It's the first time in decades, that we have not had a budget. The budget's usually passed the very first part of the year. You put the budget together, gives you the parameters for the spending bills, which are the appropriations bills, and then you pass those throughout the year. Try to get done before the end of the fiscal year, which is September 30th, which is coming up here in a month, 1 month away. There has never been a budget passed this year, and that is by design. Speaker Pelosi doesn't want the numbers out there simply because they're so bad. We saw the deficits in the, if you go all the way back to, say, 2005, 2006, 2007, we saw deficits were coming down very, very slightly. Then the Speaker Pelosi took over as Speaker in 2006. They ran that first budget, which was the budget from the year before, which was passed. And then the first year that she had her budget cycle in there was 2008, and the deficit climbed to $486 billion. Then in 2009, which would have been the first budget that she had with President Obama in office, it went from $486 billion to $1.4 trillion overnight. And then this year, and the reason why they don't have a budget, they don't want the numbers out there, is because they've already blown through $1.5 trillion on their way to $1.6, $1.7 trillion within the next month. So what happens is the fiscal year is going to close. We'll be operating on a blind continuing resolution. Continuing resolutions are continue spending as they are within the budget parameters, but there are no budget parameters. So it's going to be interesting to see how this works out and if a budget is even passed. So that's one of the things that I'm concerned about as much as anything else. The spending right now is absolutely unsustainable. It cannot continue. And you've got all of these bills that are in the hopper that have yet to even be implemented. Healthcare is a perfect example, which the cost has now climbed to around $1.5 trillion, which isn't factored in there. So you're talking about a lot of spending out there that is taking place. So what's going to happen in November? Again, I said I'm not sure. Bills that we're concerned about and we're hoping to be able to stop Cap and trade is still sitting out there, the Senate version of cap and trade, which is an energy tax. That is all it is an energy tax. They're going to try to make a run at that. There's going to be a run made at amnesty for illegal immigrants. They're going to try to push that. There's going to be a push for the $1 trillion VAT tax. That's Speaker Pelosi's tax centerpiece. What it is it adds a tax to any product as it moves through the system. When it changes hands from one distributor to the next distributor or from processor to processor, there's a tax added to it. And until you get to the point where it gets to the end consumer and the tax is already built all up into the price, it's a hidden tax. Nobody really knows how much is in that particular product. But they are going to be working on that. That'll probably come after the election. Those are three of the issues that we are concerned about, what happens in that lame duck session. And again, depending on what happens in November. But it's been frustrating. It's been very frustrating. I'm excited about the election and what's coming up. Regardless of what happens, whether the House changes hands, doesn't change hands, Senate changes hands, doesn't change hands, you've still got President Obama in office, which has the ability to veto anything that's happening. So I think you're going to see a lot of tough bills put on his desk regardless, and then he's going to have to figure out what he's going to do or answer for what it is he's going to do or what it is that he is not going to do. But regardless, even if we get close and don't take the House, or even if we take the House, we're going to be able to stop and roll back a lot of this spending, which my proposal is I want to go all the way back to the 2008 budget cycle. That was only 2 years ago. Let's go back and start from that point right off the bat. And everything that's left in the stimulus, there's still a lot of money out there that was not spent. We could possibly save $400 billion. I want to freeze discretionary, but that's just for a start. If we can go back 2 years to the 2008 budget cycle, it is sustainable. And then we can build the economy from there. Right now, we're still struggling with the economy. A lot of small businesses that come before the Small Business Committee tell us, in fact, the majority tell us that nobody wants to do anything. They don't want to expand. They don't want to move forward because they don't know what's around the corner. They don't know what health care is going to cost. They don't know what's going to happen with cap and trade. They don't know who's going to pay for these mounting deficits or the debt that's the cumulative effect of the deficits. They don't know who's going to pay for it. And lots of talk of tax increases. We've got a tax increase right now at the end of the year as a result of the expiring tax cuts. And then you've got the VAT tax out there. You've got the health care tax, which is going to kick in and hit in the first part of the year. So a lot of small businesses are just holding back. And that's the reason there's very little job creation. 7 out of every 10 jobs in this country are small business jobs. And they're going to be the ones that lead us out of the economic recession, if anybody does. So when you've got small business holding back, that's the reason everything is as stifled as it is, at least in my opinion. But with that, I can go on and on and on. It's easier. I'd rather take questions and thoughts, ideas, concerns, what's on your mind, and just hear from you. Somebody's got to break the ice. Yeah, Larry.
Any estimates on how many farmers will be driven out of business if cap and trade goes through?
There aren't any estimates of it. It's hard to tell. Cap and trade is, first of all, it's going to hit every consumer out there. Particularly hard hit are going to be Midwestern states, states that use coal for their electricity. So your gas rates, or not your gas rates, but your electricity rates are going to go way up as a result of cap and trade. If you're in a manufacturing business or if you're in a transportation business, your rates are going to go up, your costs are going to go up simply because it taxes fossil fuels, it taxes carbon-based fuels pretty heavily. Agriculture is a heavy user of energy from two areas. One, the direct use of it through equipment. Second is all of the inputs, particularly fertilizer, is heavily dependent on energy to be able to produce it. It's going to make it extraordinarily hard to be able to stay in business, particularly if you're small. Interestingly enough, on cap and trade, if that bill were run through the House again today, it wouldn't pass. They struggled to get it to pass in last year, but it would not pass simply because of the election, because those members who voted for it and are in very marginal districts or very very moderate districts, they're hearing about it. They're hearing about it in a big, big way. And I think it'd be very hard for them to get it to pass again. That's the reason it's struggling in the Senate. Now, Senator Kerry, though, he wants it bad. He wants to push it and he wants to see it happen. So, again, that's as I mentioned, it's still out there. But it would be very hard on small businesses, very hard on agriculture, extremely hard on agriculture. Yes?
If the House flips, is there a possibility that the House version of cap and trade could be repealed?
Possibly, but it'll probably just go away, to be honest with you, because when the Senate version comes back, it would never, it wouldn't fly. So it'll probably just go away, and after January, it'd have to be refiled anyway. So. We can talk about football. Yeah, Mike.
Sam, can you talk a little bit about the threat to agriculture both in Missouri and nationally as far as animal agriculture and some of the things that they are facing?
In Congress, the biggest thing agriculture is facing is just is lack of understanding. There's 435 members of the House, and there's seven of us that ever engaged in production agriculture. And that makes it pretty tough to explain. And the bill has changed considerably. When you talk about the Farm Bill, the bill has changed considerably over the course of time. A very small amount of it is actually what you think of as Farm Bill. 90% of it's nutrition programs, WIC, food stamps, a variety of things. And that's the vast majority of the Farm Bill, and that's where the majority of debate comes from. Conservation programs, they are all in there. Rural development is all part of the Farm Bill. Rural development grants, that's all part of the Farm Bill. Broadband, rural deployment of broadband, that's all part of the Farm Bill. The actual Farm Bill, the traditional Farm Bill, is very small, and which is the food policy part. That's the policy part that everybody should be concerned about, because that's what that's the part that maintains our stable food supply and maintains our stability and pricing. We spend less than 10% of our disposable income on food. It's actually come down even a little bit more today. There's nowhere else in the world like that. Absolutely nowhere else in the world that you spend so little on food. And it's what makes us one of the greatest nations in the world is the ability to take our food supply for granted. And that's what we do. But it's safe, it's abundant, and it's affordable. But that's the smallest part of the actual Farm Bill. So that's the biggest challenge agriculture is facing. And then I'll throw in the EPA on top of that. The new EPA regulations, which are being implemented outside of congressional authority, are troublesome in a big way. The EPA is doing through regulatory power, just implementing, for instance, in cap and trade. They're implementing a lot of the cap and trade provisions since Congress hasn't passed the bill. To their frustration, they're just implementing a lot of it through regulatory authority with the being pushed with the authority of the administration. They are a component of the administration. And so that's a concern because there's a lot of threat involved with that when it comes to the Clean Water Act, which right now the big debate in Washington is whether or not to remove the term navigable out of the Clean Water Act. Right now the EPA has jurisdiction over all navigable waterways. If they remove the term navigable, that means they're going to have jurisdiction over any body of water that's out here. That includes ponds on your farm, creeks on your farm, and total authority to regulate those and stop you from doing whatever it is you're doing. For instance, watering cattle in them, have an open watering of cattle in a farm pond, that would come under the regulation of the EPA. And what contaminants are in that water as a result of cattle standing in it, which is a big deal with the EPA. You know, that's the last thing we want. But that's just one area that EPA is overreaching its bounds and going beyond congressional authority, and it takes congressional action to reverse that, which is unfortunate. Yeah,
CMU, just says. Department of Agriculture here has the Tampa talking about sustaining agriculture in this part of the state, and really well beyond. Did you think about the role of Northwest Missouri State University in terms of helping drive agriculture as well as international entrepreneurship? What do you see there? What do you see our role? What would you like us to focus on?
Your role is you have a tremendous role to play in all of this because agriculture is changing all the time, and Rod knows that. Just from when we were growing up to now, agriculture has changed so much, and it's highly competitive. It's high, getting more and more highly advanced, and we need those young people that understand that. And you have to treat agriculture as, and I've always said that, you have to treat agriculture as a business, not a way of life. Because if it's just a way of life and you can't compete and you can't make it, then you're not going to go very far. You have to treat it like a business, and you have to have a business mind when you're doing it. And you're dealing with very narrow margins, but high capital outlay. In many cases, it's extremely capital intensive. It's extremely labor intensive. And so it's that as much as anything else is training those young people to be good farmers, to be good stewards of the land. And that's part of it, too. If you don't take care of your resources and the land, then it's not going to take care of you. And, all of those things come into play. But just the latest in technology when it comes to genetics, when it comes to proteomics, when it comes to everything involved with growing a crop and doing a good job and keeping it safe for the in the food supply is it's a huge undertaking. It really is. And things like this facility are obviously very awesome. But I'm tickled to death to have Northwest Missouri State University up here, and I know a lot of kids. You got a tremendous ag department, and it's growing and flourishing, and I like that. It wasn't very long ago they were talking about dropping the ag department, if you remember that. And I'm tickled to death that it's right here and alive and well. Yes?
How about the state of higher education seen from the congressional point of view in terms of more focused scrutiny on some of the for-profit education and things? Is this something that is on the radar of Congress, or is it not as much as these other items that you...
Not as much as the other items, but it doesn't necessarily mean it might not be in the Education Committee, which I'm not a member of. As far as, for the most part, it's when you're dealing with higher education, it's usually just research stuff, grants, and that sort of thing is what you hear about from the majority of members out there. And now the Education Committee, I think they go into a lot more detail and everything on in terms of higher education overall, but not a lot. Much more focus on elementary and secondary education, or elementary and secondary education sort of thing. So, not a lot, to be honest with you. That at least comes to the level of the entire house.
It's the impression we get too. So. Well. So.
Yeah. You talked a little bit about unsustainable debt levels. What are the strategies in play right now to try and control that?
There aren't any right now, and you've got a deficit that is crossing. 1.5, or it's actually past 1.5, and going to come in somewhere north of $1.6 trillion. That's, remember, the deficit's 1 year spending above what the government's going to take in. That's just 1 year, and we've had 2 years of that. We've had $3 trillion worth of spending above what the government's going to take in 18 months. And I remember the entire budget just a few years ago was $3 trillion. When I was in, I don't know, it was somewhere around that time frame of 2005, 2006, when we got close, it was about $2.7 trillion, and we've seen this in 18 months, another $3 trillion, and that's just deficit spending, and so it is completely unsustainable. Who's buying our debt right now? China's done. Their economy's in a mess right now. That's a good question on who's going to buy the rest of the debt as it moves forward, and quite frankly, it worries me when you have certain countries carrying so much of it the way it is. But regardless, it's unsustainable. You can't continue. It just cannot continue. It will break the nation. And when you're paying out as much as we are right now, just in interest as a part of the budget, you can't. It's unsustainable, absolutely unsustainable.
So a follow-up question, if I might. If the House flips, how would that affect strategies in play?
What will happen is the budget will come from the president. and it'll start in the House. Or he will have his recommendations. That's actually how it does it. The Congress passes the budget. And then you'll see considerable changes made to it. You know, let's take, for example, let's a real simple scenario. If we go back to the 2008 budget, for instance, and cut the rest of the stimulus and cut, you know, freeze discretionary, then it's going to go to the Senate. I don't know what will happen in the Senate then, but ultimately a compromise will come up and it'll go to the president. He'll probably veto it. Then it'll start the process over again, and it's going to go back and forth and back and forth. But those tough choices have to be made, and those tough decisions have to be made. You know, and the president needs to answer as to why it is he's vetoing, you know, this budget for this reason or whatever the case may be. But that's where the battle will come down, and that'll take place for two more years. And that'll probably be centerpiece of what's going to happen to the presidential election, which will start 1 year from now. So possibly just a little earlier or less than 1 year from now. There's going to be some pretty tough budget fights.
If it goes down that way in November, who do you think will be the Speaker of the House?
It's hard to tell, to be honest with you, because there's a lot of water to cross underneath the bridge, and you know, I don't know if we'll take over. It's just hard to tell. You know, and there's 40 seats that split us right now. There's a 40-seat margin, actually 41 seats. you know, and the turnover could be anywhere from 35 to 60. It's just hard to tell. We've never, in all of my, in fact, I don't think Republicans have ever had a margin as wide as what we're seeing right now. The margins have always been, you know, we got down six seats, the six-seat margin, five-seat margin. There was a 12-seat margin at one time when we were in office, I remember. Very narrow margins, but, and I'll probably be that way for either side, whichever side is in power. Because they will lose a lot of seats, but it'll be a narrow margin, probably somewhere in the 10 seat range. Yes?
Transportation bill, what are the odds on keeping the 15% set aside for officers?
Well, I'm working real hard on that. The question is about the BRO program, and which is the bridge replacement, the off-system bridge replacement program, which our counties use heavily, particularly our rural counties. What it does is take... It sets aside 15% of the transportation dollars, federal transportation dollars, and it's a matching program for counties to be able to use to replace these bridges. Missouri is one of those states that has a lot of off-system bridges. They're in terrible shape, and that's one of the reasons why you've seen a lot of replacement around the countryside is the county and townships. We have a lot of township governments in northwest Missouri in particular, they're using those dollars, accessing those dollars. Well, the proposal is just to remove that and absorb that money right into the highway bill, which is up for reauthorization. And several of us in the Midwest are working very hard to keep that in place. And so far, we've been able to do it. But it's a real delicate issue right now, and we're trying to keep it in place. It isn't just Missouri. A lot of Midwestern states use that. But it comes down to that fight and the interesting thing is the chairman of the Transportation Committee, who is a Midwesterner, is the major pusher of this. But it comes down to that fight of getting that money into the general highway fund to be used up in other areas rather than being used on roads or rather than being used on bridges in the Midwest. So it's an old fight that's been out there for a long time, but we need to keep it in place because it's vitally important to these counties. Nottoway County uses it a lot. Atchison County uses it a lot. All of our northwest counties heavily use that that program to replace these bridges. Two more. Yes.
Talking about grants now. What's the percentage of the total grant program against the total income of the United States?
I don't know. I do not know. And you've got so many different areas of grants. You know, the one I'm most familiar with would be rural development because it comes through the Department of Agriculture. And, you know, in rural development, that's everything from sewer systems to water systems to fire trucks in some cases comes through rural development. And a lot of that rural development, part of it is loans, too. Like a lot of hospitals, rural hospitals use that. They take it's a loan from a USDA loan. To build a hospital, but it is paid back. But there are grants out there. But I could not tell you. That's a good question, though. I'd like to find out what the total grant compared to the income of the country is.
My feelings are that if you take that total grant program and you go to throwing out everything in there that doesn't have some meaning to rural development or city development, actually identified research program or something that you could almost balance the budget a little bit.
Well, in terms of discretionary spending, you mean like some of these goofy projects that are out there, things like that, like Christmas tree museums in North Carolina? If you're talking about that, which is a goofy program, and it was a grant. The entire discretionary budget that's non-defense is 16% of the budget. I do know that. The entire discretionary budget, which includes veterans, are under discretionary spending. All of your earmarked stuff is under discretionary spending. Non-defense is discretionary too, but it's a separate discretionary category because it's defense. And then you have your basic breakdown of the budget is discretionary, defense, and entitlements. And entitlements are Medicaid, Medicare, which is the fastest growing area of the budget and the largest area of the budget. And then Social Security would be the fourth kind of piece that's out there. But as far as grants and stuff like that, and I would say just what you're probably talking about is just flat out earmarks, some of the goofy earmarks that are out there, which my thought on earmark reform is pretty simple. Stand up and defend it. We don't have anybody defending these earmarks. You know, if it's a road or, you know, if we're doing, you know, Highway 71 is a perfect example. Federal dollars in Highway 71, widening it 4-lane. That's an earmark. And, you know, I'll stand up and defend it. I'll defend it all day long. But if it's a Christmas tree museum in North Carolina or South Carolina, I want them standing up and defending why tax dollars should go to pay for that. Now, the sheer weight of the number of those out there will shrink it considerably just simply because it's going to take so much time. But you watch stuff fall off the table real fast when you got to stand up and explain why it is you want dollars for some of these goofy things. And they'll just go away. Because right now what happens is a lot of them just get dropped into a conference report when the conference report's moving back and forth between the House and the Senate. They just get dropped in, and nobody really knows who did it. And it's just in there. It just ends up being in there. And a lot of it's staff-driven, too. If the member actually has to stand up and defend it on the floor of the House, then you're going to eliminate a lot of that stuff. You're going to eliminate a whole lot of it. And I think that's a real simple earmark reform request, and then put people on the spot to vote for it. You know, there are a lot of earmarks out there. I guarantee you, I'm not going to vote for. But if it's an infrastructure earmark, that's a whole different ballgame. So, yes.
My question is on healthcare reform. I'm a superintendent of a small school. Right now, healthcare premiums are 5% of our entire budget. 10 years ago, healthcare premiums were 1% of our budget. We were covering more people and they had better benefits. If we do have a change in Congress, what's going to be the approach to addressing those kinds of rising healthcare costs?
And it's going to, and this is a long question, but the push is going to be repeal the healthcare bill that was passed. And then replace it with something that is workable, health insurance reform, for instance. My proposal, which I'll speak to it specifically, but there's a lot of proposals out there, is to do a version of associated health plans, which is allowing people to be able to group together and negotiate their rates on a huge, much bigger scale. If you use teachers, for instance, you could do it from three or four standpoints. You could do it from the screen, and you have to be able to cross state lines to make it work because I want those insurance companies competing against each other. And you also get much, much larger scale plans. But you could do it from schools working together. You could do it from the teachers' organizations, whether it's NEA or MSTA doing it. You could do it from a variety. You know, you could have elementary and secondary principals organizations doing it. I'm just throwing that out. The example I like to use is a group called OIDA. It's the Owner-Operator Independent Drivers Association. It's the Independent Truck Drivers Association. They have 10,000 members. They're headquartered in my district. That's another reason why I like to use them. They have 10,000 members nationwide. And these are one-person small businesses, or two people. Sometimes it's a husband and wife team. They own a truck, and they do contract hauls all over the nation. They're going out there, and they're getting their insurance as an individual, and that's hard to do, and it's expensive to do. But they can't, since they're a nationwide organization, they can't. Organization can go out and negotiate a health plan. Well, if they're out there negotiating on behalf of 10,000, or let's say they don't get them all to participate, they only get 8,000 of them to participate, you just change the playing field considerably. Because now you're negotiating for better rates, you're negotiating for better plans, you're negotiating for services, you're also absorbing all those pre-existing conditions that are out there too, because these companies are going to be competing to get that business. Big plans are money makers for those companies, because the vast majority of individuals are healthy and that's where they get their premiums from. But if you can do that, you can do it on a large scale. That's capitalism. That's we're using the system rather than taxpayers putting 1.5 trillion. That's what it is at this point. It's still going up to do what was done. And then the next thing you do too is what's going to happen is we're going to pass a medical malpractice reform, which isn't in this bill. It is a huge cost driver, and it needs to be passed. Now, whether or not the president signs it has yet to be determined. He won't sign anything that's going to remove his plan, but that doesn't mean it can't be done. And I'll tell you why. There's still 4 years before the majority of that plan is implemented. Tax is going in place right away, but the plan itself doesn't get implemented for another 4 years. And it's much easier to remove something and replace it before it actually goes into effect than it is if it goes into effect immediately. So that's one of the things, at least, that I'm working on. But there's going to be a lot of proposals out there which will be debated and moved back and forth. But that's what the general plan is, too. In Missouri, my gosh, Missouri's Prop C vote was telling. It really was. It settled. It wasn't even close. 72%, and now you got 23 other states wanting to do exactly the same thing. You got some states that are already suing the federal government because they don't want to participate. They did it a little bit different way, or took a different route. But that is absolutely telling what took place, and it's going to be interesting to see how this moves forward. But folks are upset with Washington right now, and upset with Congress. What adds to that is when you have people like Speaker Pelosi making statements like, we're going to do this anyway, despite what the country thinks. And that was her exact words. That's what's got people fired up. Last year when I was doing my town hall meetings, my healthcare town hall meetings a year ago, I remember thinking, my gosh, it's an eternity between now and the election next year. I hope this enthusiasm stays. And here we are 1 year later, and it's just done nothing but built. People are paying attention. They know what's going on. They know exactly how they feel about this, and they're focused in on it. And it's exciting for the country, I think. So we'll see what happens. But thanks, everybody, for coming out. Just call me if you have anything. Just let me know. I'm in the phone book, as always, and home every week. But I appreciate it. Thank you. Appreciate it very much. Folks, we're very happy to have Congressman Graves with us. Please, our Department of Ag faculty, staff, students are here. Jim, farm managers here to answer any questions you have about the plan itself. There are light snacks, refreshments here. Please partake there. Otherwise, have a great Bearcat Week as well. Thank you.